This is the Perfectly Mentored Podcast with your host, Jason Portnoy.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Perfectly Mentored. I'm your host, Jason Portnoy. My guest today is Kurt Elster, one of the most highly regarded independent consultants in his industry. He's a senior e-commerce consultant who helps Shopify merchants like Jay Leno's Garage uncover hidden profits in their websites through his e-commerce agency, EtherCycle. With 1 million downloads, Kurt's also best known for hosting the unofficial Shopify podcast. It's kind of weird. We were just talking about this offline. We've been talking on Twitter and in the same circles for a long time. I'm surprised it took us this long to connect, but super to have you on, super to finally connect with you today. Kurt, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
I said we were talking and saying, you know, like, oh, we're both extroverts, and for an extrovert, as grateful as we should be for the position we're in during this pandemic, it's so hard to be disconnected from people as an extrovert. So really, like, these guest interviews, that's what's keeping me going.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. We should just, like, do a bunch of podcasts just so I feel like I have more friends and, like, I'm seeing people.
That's really, like, I'm out, like, I get in the darkest moods. And then I do a video call, and then I'm like, oh, I feel better for a few hours.
Person, I see someone.
Yes.
Someone that's not your family.
I joked earlier, I said, oh, I'm going to jump off the roof so that the paramedics will come, and I'll be like, new friends.
Look, why don't you tell the listeners for a little bit how you got started in the whole e-com game?
Sure. So, I mean, looking back on it, I suppose I was involved in e-commerce for my entire adult life. Starting as a teenager, I was doing retail arbitrage on eBay. In college, I continued with my eBay businesses. I was selling gray market software, and I didn't see the issue with that. And I was selling t-shirts that, like, wildly violated copyright. I got a cease and desist from Warner Brothers. And, like, I wasn't being malicious. I literally didn't know. I was like, what's the problem? Like, these White Stripes t-shirts are original designs by me. Like, no, it doesn't work like that, buddy. But yeah, I graduated into a recession, a terrible job market, and I always knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. When I was a kid, my dad lost his job, and he said, if you work for somebody, you can never get fired. So by the time I was a teenager, I was telling people, when people would say, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? I'd say an entrepreneur, and they say, oh, great, you're going to own your own business. What is it? I said, I don't know yet. And I didn't. And when I graduated business school, I still didn't know yet. And so I needed a job. It was dark days. It was 2008. And so I went to work for a aftermarket auto parts dropshipper. I'm a car guy. I knew eBay. They needed an eBay channel manager. And so I started working there. And after a year of that, I was really like, it got me excited about entrepreneurship again. And I was tying my shoes to go to work. I broke down crying. And I knew it was because I had betrayed myself by not being an entrepreneur, by working for someone else. I felt bad about it. And so I put in my 7-day notice, and then I left to go build my own e-commerce platform. Well, thank God I didn't know what I didn't know, because it turns out building an e-commerce platform is really hard. And so that idea went nowhere. And to keep the lights on, because the recession was so bad, I got office space, and they were so grateful to get rid of it. They said, we'll let you have it for free for 6 months. And I was like, well, I'll be successful by then. So I got to keep the lights on. Necessity is the mother of invention. And so I started selling brochure sites to local businesses. And I said, well, and the way I did it was I slipped a letter underneath all these local businesses' doors with their first name written. And that worked. And I said, you know what? I could scale this up. The exact same strategy will work with big Chicago creative agencies. I'm in Chicago. And sure enough, like, within a few months, I found myself, I'm doing client projects for Verizon, the NFL, and Hilton Hotels. But those projects were really hard. I was tearing my hair out. And at the same time, I had a friend who owned a bike shop say, hey, I hate my website. And I said, what do you hate about it? He said, it's too hard to use. And he said, you know websites, help me out. And I said, well, there's this thing called Shopify, and I hear it's really easy, and it's e-commerce. Let's try that. And again, not knowing what I'm getting myself into, without ever having even logged into Shopify, I said, I'll just design and develop a custom theme for it. And sure enough, we did, and it was successful. And so they invited us. They only had 40 employees at the time. They invited us to be part of the experts program, the partner program. And that was getting us some client work. Our second ever project was Banded Dudes Golf Course. If you're into golf, you know this is a cool place. And so, like, I had these kind of dueling, these parallel businesses going, where I'm doing e-commerce and I'm doing this creative work with these big brands. And I realized that what we would finish the Shopify site to go, that was easy. It's not that it was easy. It's that we were good at it. That was our core skill set. And so I said, well, why am I doing anything else? At which point I did 5 years ago, I said, I'm the Shopify guy. I had a newsletter with 500 people. I emailed them, I'm the Shopify guy. But having that clear positioning, within a month of that, I was getting referrals from people I didn't know to people I didn't know for Shopify, this like burgeoning platform. And I said, I want to start a podcast. And my business partner goes, I'm like, but I don't want to edit it. And my business partner goes, well, you know, I produced the Onion's, you know, the Onion, the newspaper, their first podcast for the AV Club. I said, I didn't know that. He's like, yeah, I recorded it and edited it and posted, produced it. I was like, no, I had no idea. So at that point, I had no excuse to do a podcast. And now 5 years later, that thing's got 1.2 million downloads. And if you are on Shopify long enough and considering hiring someone to help you with your store, you probably won't hire me, but it becomes inevitable that our paths will cross at the very least. So yeah, now here I am.
I love that. And so many different ways I want to take this, but I want to take a step back for a second and say, look, my first business in entrepreneurship before I started the agency was I had a clothing brand and I started off making t-shirts. And I started off making t-shirts to sell based off sports teams. And I violated every single licensing right possible. I got cease and desist letters from almost every professional sports league telling me to shut down my first story. Because like you, I'm like, but I'm changing the logo around. This isn't the actual.
I was like, what? I made it. I'm not writing somebody else's creative license.
Yeah, I'm not writing Boston Red Sox. I put a sock on it and it's red and it says Boston. I created the design myself. It's a special design. I hear you it's funny that we both kind of started off and on that side of things. But you said something interesting. You said that, you know, you landed Verizon, the NFL. I'd imagine when you're starting off on your own, people listening were like, what's the problem? Those are dream clients, right? If people listed like top 100 clients, I'm guarantee you those would probably fall on most people's lists. What's the problem and what advice do you have for listeners who are sitting there saying, hey, well, I want those big clients. What's the difference and why was it such a pulling your hair out type of experience?
Sure. So the issue was we're the low man on the totem pole because it went like the client. And when you're dealing with a huge client, there's all kinds of stakeholders and things going on in the background that you don't know about. And so that can result in like, we're all in agreement and everyone's happy and we're executing your vision. Well, then in the background, someone you never heard of is like, well, you know, the CEO's dog doesn't like the color blue. So you got to go take all the blue out of this website. And by the way, that's like a call you get at 8 p.m. and you're expected to deal with it because the website launches in 4 hours. Like that's the kind of stuff you get into when you're dealing with these huge clients and you're really like a pair of hands. You're doing fulfillment work. And so, because it went like the giant client, the marketing agency, who generally at this time, the idea of an integrated marketing agency was kind of like a new and big idea. And really it just meant like a traditional ad agency that also had digital skills. Well, the problem, and I knew that from my MBA. And so I also knew, like I knew that those agencies probably didn't have that experience, like staffing wise. So this supposedly integrated agency, air quotes, was really just outsourcing it and hiring it to just small boutique people like myself. I mean, at the time it was me and two guys. And one of those guys is still with me, my co-host on my show, Paul Rita. At that point, like you're just doing the fulfillment and you're expected to shut up and do the work. And at the same time, like the agency is this middleman who has to make a profit on it. And it's also like totally willing to throw you under the bus, right? For anything. And you also have to deal with the agency's internal politics. Like agencies as a client are not amazing. I mean, it could be great when things line up, but it can also be stuff like, well, you know, the project manager quit and there's a new one. And also they hired a technical director and the technical director wants to bring in his own team. So he fired everybody and then also made up a bunch of excuses as to why you didn't work. So you got fired unexpectedly, but paid for most of the project. But then also 4 months later, that new team didn't work out. And now they want you to come back and finish it. And they're going to threaten to sue you if you don't. That happened. Like that's a real story. And it was at that point when I went, maybe I should just work with these small local entrepreneurs where it's one-on-one. It's me and the key stakeholder, the decision maker, because it's the owner and the founder, like right there. And there's that entrepreneurial enthusiasm and that spirit that connects, as opposed to just like, well, somebody needs this to look cool on their resume, and or like you are someone's pawn in some weird corporate power struggle. No, I'm not interested in that.
There's also trust, right? Sorry to interrupt, but there's trust in you. When you work with someone smaller, they're really looking at you as the expert they hired versus, you know, when you're dealing with someone big, you're saying something, you know, Tim, whose niece used to build websites, says her like 6-year-old niece says, no, that's not the way it works. They're not looking at you as the expert anymore. Like you said, you really become the fulfillment versus the smaller people.
Hands versus brains is what it becomes. And I want to be both. Right? Like you need both to be satisfying. And I look at, like, I am grateful and I'm in a position where I was rapidly able to like pick and choose the work that I wanted that suited me. And certainly there were crap projects I took to keep the lights on, but ultimately, like, you don't just want an income and to be busy. Like, you want to be fulfilled by the work, because otherwise you burn out. And that was the missing piece that I was looking for. And so initially, like based on my experience, those big agency projects, I mean, they were like 50 grand a pop. It was non-trivial income. Whereas, you know, the small business, local business stuff, all right, there it's like 10 grand each. Okay, so I got to do 5 of those to equal one creative agency project. But at some point, it wasn't worth it. Where like the effective hourly rate, if you also included the time I spent laying awake worrying about it with just extreme anxiety, no longer worth it. It's not worth the money. Some things are not worth the money.
I love the way you just broke that down in the sense of look at it from an hourly rate. Yeah, you're
EHR,
making more money.
Effective hourly rate that you got to think about how much any time that your brain is thinking about it, include that in your like personal estimate of what your effective hourly rate is.
So I asked Harley, we had Harley Finkelstein on the podcast. I've known Harley for a long time. I asked him the same question. So I'm going to ask you, for the listeners deciding to build an e-commerce site today, why Shopify? I mean, I have my reasons aside from we're also as an agency Shopify partners, but why would someone choose Shopify over WooCommerce, over BigCommerce, or even like any of the other sites?
I truly believe in Shopify's vision for entrepreneurship. I have seen them champion and empower entrepreneurs. I think they are all in on that. And I greatly admire that ethos. But I mean, ultimately, like, that is, it's vision stuff, it's mission stuff, it's fun, but it's also a little hand wavy. So if you want like the real hardcore reason why, it's the same reason why we settled to exclusively work on the Shopify platform 5 or 6 years ago. As I said, wait, this plat, because so what I did, I'm quite risk averse. And I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, like, I know I could sell Shopify stores. I'm going to use the same sales letter, landing page, and run some Google ads. And I'm going to sell projects for Lemonstand, BigCommerce, Magento, PrestaShop, and Shopify. I did not do WooCommerce, but I was a WordPress developer, so I was quite familiar. And I did one of each. I worked on all of them. And I went, nothing comes close to Shopify for ease of use, for support, for documentation, and most importantly, the ecosystem. So I think the thing you get with Shopify that, you know, you get all of those, I don't think anyone has all of those things overlapping other than Shopify, but the thing you get with Shopify that is most important, most powerful, is that ecosystem. And they have been developing that since so early on in the company, that you've got just this true, like whatever feature, skill, or talent you need for your store, there is a Shopify partner that 9 times out of 10 will offer exactly what you need if you can find them. And I think that is the real value and magic of Shopify. Like, you've got this base amazing platform, and then you've added tremendous extensibility of it in terms of this ecosystem.
When it comes to, I mean, e-commerce, one of the biggest things I've seen, it's underrated, I would say. One of the biggest underrated parts is CRO, conversion rate optimization. Right, mm-hmm. if you could bump something up from a 2.5% conversion rate to 3%, you're making a lot more money. So when a client comes to you and says, I love the sound effects, love it. When a client comes to you and says, now you're just showing me up as a podcast host, by the way. Now I'm seeing like what the elite look like as a podcast host. I got to get sound effects now.
Like, just throw some cash at some equipment and you'll be good to go.
So when a client comes to you or hires you guys and says, hey, we want to increase our conversion rate, is there like a checklist that you go through? What's the starting place for that?
So what's interesting about like conversion rate optimization in terms of like traditional split testing is it really should be the last thing you do as far as optimizing the store goes. So I think much sooner you start with, okay, what is broken about this site? Like number one, I want to go through the site and like, are there obvious problems with it? Can I fix those first? All right, let's fix the stuff that's broken. And you'd be surprised. Websites of all sizes have weird things that are broken on them because the team builds it, looks at it on day one, works their way around an issue and goes, oh, we'll fix that later. And then if they just get so used to it, it's like, you can't see the forest through the trees. It's change blindness. You're just not seeing these issues anymore. And this happens like within days of launching a new site. So number one, you need like a third party person to go like, well, this is a little iffy and this is a road bump and this is like, you know, a little annoying or this could work better. So like fix that stuff, number one. Number two, all right, let's stick to convention. Everyone has shopped from, anyone who buys from you, the independent third party e-commerce store, has probably bought from major retailers online. Walmart, Best Buy, Amazon, Target. And so those players, whether you like it or not, they have set the convention. They have already trained your customers. This is what shopping online looks like, feels like. This is how it works. And so, okay, step two is, can we get this site in line with those conventions? And the advantage to that is now when I land on your site, I'm not annoyed and I'm confident because nothing's broken. Number two, I already know how to shop here because by borrowing those patterns from other sites, this feels comfortable and familiar and I know what to do. All right, number three then becomes, well, let's ask customers. Hey, why did you buy? Who would you recommend this product for? When we ask that, we find out how they see themselves. And then, all right, if you didn't buy, so I want to use, this is, the first example is post-purchase survey. The second example is on-site exit intent survey. If you didn't make a purchase today, what stopped you? Okay, now I know why people buy, how they see themselves, so I can work that into positioning. Sometimes you could take some of this stuff to like copy-paste survey answers into the H1 on the homepage, boom, new positioning statement. And if I know consistently like, well, the same issue keeps coming up for people. Now I could put that issue, now I know what objections are and I could bust those. Okay, got all of that. Everything moves up on the store. Now, can I increase quality of traffic? Great. Okay, we did all of that. What else do we do? That's when you start split testing. That's when I'm going to go back and be like, all right, we literally are just going to dream up. We're going to brainstorm things and throw it against the wall and see what sticks. That's what split testing is for. But until you have that base, until you have everything else in place, you have no business split testing. And you probably don't have the traffic to support it until you've done all those other things.
So what are some of those obvious problems that you come across right off the bat?
Man, number one is navigation by far. Oh my gosh, you land on a site and like the first link is home and then the second link is shop and then all the important stuff is buried under a nested drop-down menu and then it's like about, FAQ, a mission state. And you're like, oh geez. Go on any major retailer's website that's e-commerce, all of them. The main menu, every link of the main menu will go to a product or a category. That's it. If you have anything on your main menu that's not a product or a category, you probably did it wrong. Like, get that stuff out of there. If all of your stuff is buried under a tiny little dropdown with four letters, shop, you did it wrong. Like, I want to be able to see that at a glance. Break all that stuff out into my main menu, and then all the other stuff can go in a footer menu, can go in a secondary menu, like a top menu. That absolutely get that. No one is putting on their library hat and thinking about like taxonomy and the products. And you can see that reflected in add to cart rate. So if someone lands on my homepage, the homepage is really the storefront. If I land on the homepage and bounce, this is someone who has just walked past the storefront. They really didn't shop. They didn't go in. The homepage has one job, get them to a product or collection page. Now they're shopping. Now they're in the store. Now they're more likely to buy. And if you have like a really obtuse navigation, you're just not going to get as many people to start shopping. So like number one, man, focus on that navigation. And if you're like, oh, this is confusing, it's hard to work with, do a card sort exercise. When I got a big navigation, I don't know what to do with. I print everything out. I print out a link list. I cut up pieces of paper. I glue the links onto postcards and I throw them in a big pile, just a big mess. And then I just start trying to group it. I start just messing with it, grouping it, rearranging it. And then I start trying to arrange it in a menu. And then I take a picture of it. Then I sleep on it. Then I let my Roomba run it over, mess all up. And I do it again the next day. And now, okay, now I've got, I'll do it again, take a picture of it, send it to the client. I go, I think this is a menu that makes sense. And if you really want to get fancy, you have a group of people do it. And you kind of use that to figure out how things should be grouped.
And I wonder how many people don't even come close to putting that much time into doing that.
But like, think about what I said though. None of it is hard.
No, I know. Just
yeah, like, you don't want to put it in the work. It's so easy and no one does it.
So now what are some of the, like, so you just talked about that. So assuming they fix the little things and they're ready for some conversion rate, where's the starting begin? Do you start at the product page, the checkout page, the homepage? How do you figure out where you need to start testing?
Yeah, I would base it around data. Like, once we're in that point, can we want to be data driven as much as possible, because if it's like an uninformed random test, the success rate in the industry, if you're lucky, is 1 out of 5 tests will be successful. If you're just like making stuff up to see what happens, ideally use Google Analytics and figure out like, okay, this page in our flow has the highest bounce rate or the highest exit rate. Try and figure out the pages that have issues first, the ones that are causing you problems, that are leaky funnels. Or look in your Shopify analytics. And if it's like, oh, my conversion rate's 2% and my reach checkout rate is 4%, but my add to cart rate is 12%. Okay, well, I actually kind of know then that the issue is probably on the cart page, given those numbers, or in the checkout, probably the cart page. So maybe I want to start split testing ideas on the cart page. Like, I 100% want to try and identify, I want to try and narrow down a problem area. And that could be like, well, okay, we know this cart the cart page is the weak link here. All right, so now I'm going to run a heat map on that cart page. Ah, okay, we see there's maybe some issues, like there's stuff that people are clicking on that they shouldn't, or there's things that they're not clicking on. So let's just try split testing by hiding elements on that page. And does that make the site better? Ah, okay. So like, just throwing stuff against the wall, like a total shot in the dark, you're going to frustrate yourself 4 out of 5 times. But if it's more informed, if there's a hypothesis behind it, now your success rate could be more like 50-50 or 60-40.
And if you're looking at that, so what are some of the benchmark numbers? If you know, for the listeners paying attention, what should their conversion rate on their site be? What's a good bounce rate, add to cart rate? Like, let's go over some of the key metrics.
Okay. So I think one of the advantages to working with someone who is experienced in Shopify, one of my secret special skills is I can read the tea leaves in the data. I have touched thousands of Shopify stores at this point. So I have just a head full of these benchmarks, but they are so dependent on what you sell and who your audience is and how you market the store. Because truthfully, quality of traffic is the biggest factor in conversion rate. But all right, the average conversion rate among the really the top successful e-commerce stores on the web is 2.2%. And like, I pay too much money for a bunch of industry white papers that give me this data. And honestly, that feels high. It truly does. But I found like conversion rate and average order value are inversely correlated. Like, one of the sites with the highest conversion rate I ever saw, it sold body jewelry. And the average, you know, body jewelry is like $3 for some nipple rings, right? So like, I don't have to think, that's an impulse purchase. I don't got to think too hard about it. So there, yeah, of course the conversion rate's really high. But if I'm, you know, a different website where I'm selling $300 watch straps for Rolexes, the conversion rate's probably going to be, you know, if it's 0.5%, we might go, wow, that's great. We got it up past 0.25%. So number one, like, you want to know, where am I getting the traffic from and what my, your average order value is. But like, one of the sites with the absolute highest conversion rate I ever saw, they ran a blog. The blog was all at like, talked exclusively about, you know, solving basic problems related to pets. And then the blog had links in the sidebar and links in the articles to a e-commerce store, a Shopify store that sold a lot of the stuff that they recommended. And that store had a conversion rate of like a bad day was 10% for them. So that's where you see the quality of traffic comes into play, because the only people going to that site had Googled for a problem, found an article with the solution, and then clicked through. Well, of course the conversion rate on that's amazing. So, like, honestly, like, I view myself as a CRO expert, but in reality, I think what I'm doing is revenue optimization. It's like a much more holistic approach, and CRO is just one tool in that toolbox.
So what are some of the, like, the main things that you found annoy shoppers on a site?
Or
I guess ingredients needed, okay. I guess ingredients needed for an e-commerce site to succeed.
I like that annoy question. Okay. I think the annoy question is really good. Cause if you, like, when you talk to your customers, you know, you go back and forth in an email, you have a customer support exchange, you're dealing with people who bought from you. Like, you know them. I want to hear from the people who never bought from you, who are like, went on your site, were like, oh my God, fuck this shit, and just quit. Like, that's the people who are talking to them is what's going to make you money.
Yep.
And honestly, when we do these exit intent customer surveys, or like you mine your live chat, or you go through your support requests, you can uncover a lot of this stuff. And so what I'll do is I'll compile all that in a spreadsheet, and then I'll put it in a text analyzer that picks out key phrases. And it'll be like, well, this is the top phrase that keeps coming up. These are the top words. And so you can figure out what the issues are. One of the issues that always blows me away, if you have a site that has like just every collection has a couple out of stock items, that drives people crazy. It's extremely frustrating because it's, you know, they're like, hey, here's this really delicious meal you can eat. Oh, wow, I really want to eat that meal. Oh, sorry. They're out in the kitchen. They don't have it anymore. That's a very frustrating experience. Styles, what are you doing? Can you what? Where was I? All right. Out of stock products are a consistently a tremendously frustrating experience for customers. So maybe you want to, like in Shopify, in your collections go, if inventory stock, or add a rule that says inventory stock must be greater than zero. That way, when a product goes out of stock, it's taken out of the collection, but it's still available on the store. It still has that SEO value. That's like a real annoyance for people. Shipping is a common complaint, especially international shipping. You know, so like a lot of people, the U.S. spends more on e-commerce than anyone else, but there's plenty of people around the world who want to buy from your U.S. store. So like really high international shipping costs are a big annoyance and deterrent for people. And not having financing, like increasingly, especially younger consumers, millennials and Zoomers will appreciate financing because they changed how credit cards can work and be marketed over 10 years ago. And it actually restricted access to credit. Like a lot of people got credit by getting a crappy credit card with a high interest rate in college, but at least that got them a credit score, right? And now it's harder. So there's some people who don't have a great credit card, don't have a great score, or they have a credit card with an outrageous interest rate. Whereas like these financing options like Sezzle, 0%. Well, that's better than any credit card. So like they'll complain about price or lack of financing, high shipping and out of stock items. Like those really are the three most common complaints I see.
And what are some of the ingredients needed? Like what's needed on a store? Like the main stuff that you say a store must have, whether it's reviews, whether it's a chat support in order to succeed 2020 and beyond.
All right. So number one, I think the one consistent factor I've seen that separates our most successful clients from the less successful clients, it's not design, it's content. The ones that are just prolific content creators just naturally end up creating a community, and that dramatically helps them. So I think having content creation helps quite a bit, number one. Two, tell a story. So many brands resist coming out from behind the curtain and revealing themselves and being like, yeah, I'm just, you know, some guy who feels passionately about this and I make this product. They feel insecure about it, so they hide. They're like, we at Acme Corp, no one cares. No one wants that. There's a reason why like Target hires someone like Maria Bamford to be their spokesperson. It's because they need a face. Well, you as a solopreneur can be that face of your business easily. And there's a reason why like Brand Story is so successful. It's because it works. So having, like number two, telling your story about yourself works. One of the best I've seen is recycledfirefighter.com. Jake Starr, I love the man dearly. his about page, it is literally his life story. Not exaggerating. It starts with his childhood, moves on through to adulthood and like getting married. And like, oh, by the way, he also happens to sell wallets made out of recycled fire hose. But he straight up told his life story in this about page. And I think that telling your story is extremely important, critical to your success. So, and then, like, notice all the stuff we're talking about. It actually is not e-commerce. It's not design. Some of the ugliest sites I've seen were the best converting. The content is what matters. Like you said earlier, you commented on my podcasting gear. You're like, oh man, I'm dealing with the pros now. The thing is, all right, good audio design is like audio quality on a podcast. Good audio quality doesn't hurt. Bad audio quality doesn't help. And I think the same is true for design, and people overemphasize the importance of design. Just give me a site that's easy to read and that has a compelling story. That's all anybody wants.
So let's talk about design mistakes and messaging mistakes you see store owners making.
Sure. So messaging mistakes is when someone that goes, oh, what do you do? And it takes you like 2 minutes to explain it. I once called a business coach and he said, tell me what you do. And I said, oh, it, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, he stops and goes, tell me when you could tell me, you call me back when you could tell me in 10 seconds or less. Click. Hangs up. But he was right. Like, I didn't see success until I was able, started just going, I'm the Shopify guy. Well, because that's easy to remember. It's easy to keep top of mind. If it takes you 2 minutes to explain what you do to someone, you have just murdered any chance of word of mouth. So number one, like being able to concisely explain what you do, what the benefit, or what you sell, what the benefit is, and who it's for is critical. And that's where you see the really successful websites have a tagline. They have a headline. They have a positioning statement. It is to make it easy to explain what it is. I think that's the cornerstone of your marketing, because that positioning statement will also guide you through your content strategy.
One of the things I've heard you say is a merchant's biggest competitor is the back button. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So like, yeah, merchants are always worried about, so this competitor did this. Like, you don't know what they're doing. You don't know why they did that. You don't have to copy it. Really, your biggest competition is that back button. If I'm on a site and there is any kind of weird issue, be it like it's slow to load, it's confusing to find a product, I'm not going to work around and try and figure it out for you. I'm just going to click back to my Google search and move on to the next result. That's what you're fighting against. Like, you're really fighting against yourself, and no one cares about your fancy design. They don't care about your cool animated mobile menu. They just want something that they can easily navigate. I mean, think about the one website we all use more than any other, Google. Wow, there's very little going on there. I mean, it's essentially like text in a single column, or like one of the oldest and most visited websites of all time, Craigslist. That thing's all text, isn't it? But it just works, doesn't it? And so like, before you get into the fancy design, man, you just got to make a site that is easy to use and straightforward. Otherwise, you're just going to lose people to that back button. Or they're going to get, you know, frustrated and go back to like, I just go back to stalking my ex on Facebook. Like, that's what you're up against. Literally psychologically addictive social networks. And so if you can't hold someone's attention or you frustrate them in any way, it's over. They're going to bounce. It's like, no wonder your conversion rate is, if you have a conversion rate of 1%, be grateful 1 out of 100 people buy.
I don't know if this bothers you, but it bothers me when someone's like, oh, make sure it's mobile responsive. No, it should be mobile first, in my opinion, mobile first, desktop responsive. I think that's how design has to kind of look. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. So like, because I think what happens is, so we see on mobile, conversion rate on mobile is typically, generally, kind of sort of half of what it is on desktop. But really what is going on is a lot of people are in a research phase. Like, who just watches TV anymore? You sit on the couch with the TV on and your phone, and then you're cruising through whatever, and you're doing research. And you're like, well, you're thinking about buying stuff, or you're cruising Facebook, you see a thumb-stopping ad, you click through, oh, that's kind of cool, and then you move on with your life. Well, now that's where they need to get those touch points engaged and try and get me back to the site. And I think the reason that conversion rates on mobile are typically half of desktop is not because people aren't shopping on mobile. Look at the traffic. They definitely are. Most sites are like 85% mobile traffic now. Traditionally, mobile checkout experiences have been so bad that people will shop on mobile and then save the link for later to maybe buy it on desktop later. And so I think having express payment options is the way out of this. And once we really make that a standard, like, it baffles me when a website that is mobile friendly does not support Apple Pay and Google Pay. Why would you not? Right? No one wants to type in their credit card number on their phone. That sucks. No one's going to do it. But Apple Pay or Google Pay, man, 8 seconds I could check out. I remember the first time I did it. I wanted, and actually I wore it recently. I had this cool, it was from Zero Foxtrot, and they sold a Stormtrooper shirt. It was like, it was like a morale t-shirt for the troops, but it was a Stormtrooper. I thought it was really cool. It was sold out. Oh, it was so frustrating. I didn't buy anything, but they had it back in stock for me. I filled it out. And I'm sitting on the couch and I get an email. It goes, this item's back in stock. I click the link, the website loads, and it's got a buy now button with Apple Pay logo. I clicked it. So literally from the time I got that back in stock email, within 30 seconds, I had purchased it. And that's what you want. You want those moments where it just happens so quickly, you don't have time to second guess yourself. You're like, I'm getting this Stormtrooper shirt. And you just, on mobile, you just can't do that without express payment options like Apple Pay and Google Pay, to a lesser extent, PayPal. And you know, I've seen, this baffles me, but Shopify Pay has been available, or dynamic checkout buttons, buy now buttons, have been available for about a year now. And merchants seem really resistant to them. And it drives me insane. I'm like, all right, hear me out here. Which is going to be better for conversion rate? A 60-second checkout or a 10-second checkout? And they're like, okay, fine. And then they grudgingly let me run the buy now button on the store for a week to prove that like it's not a complete disaster and it doesn't kill your average order value. But I really wish more people would embrace it and use those mobile express payment options.
So who in let's keep it towards Shopify merchants. Who's doing it right? What are some of the best e-com sites you've come across?
Oh, man. Ooh, I'm trying to think of some of my recent favorites. All right, if you want like pure design gold, just like design so extreme it borders on masturbatory, I'm going to go with Allbirds. That is like the quintessential perfect smooth site all the way through. You want something with like just an incredible social mission attached to it in a genuine way that works really well and is also incredible design, Bombas. And I know both those guys, like that their designs have evolved and are largely informed by split testing efforts. But if you want something that's like really anti-design, I love anti-design sites. They're so fun. Pit Vipers. And like someone who their messaging is so clear across all channels, Pit Viper. Because like Pit Viper's thing, I had a friend who got their RFP before they built their Shopify store. And it literally said, we want a site that slaps the Oakleys off your face. Pit Viper sells sunglasses.
Yeah.
Like insane sunglasses. I have a
pair. Are they the one that's modeled after like the 80s gaming style?
Yeah, they're pretty, yeah. They're nuts.
Yeah.
And they like the website looks like Windows 95.
Yeah.
My wife bought me a pair and she's like, you know, she goes, you'll like this. When I unsubscribed from their newsletter, the confirmation page just said, fuck you. And like, that's a choice. So if you want like just pure like anti-design design and messaging, man, Pit Vipers, it's like, it is so clear. And the advantage to a site like that is it separates the wheat from the chaff. When you land on that site, within seconds, you've made a decision. This is for me or I hate this. And if you hate it, they don't care. Like, that's why a conversion rate is 1 out of 50 people purchase. Okay, so I don't care about the 49 people who said it was ugly. I care about that 1 out of 50 who went, this is for me. You are my people. And in the case of Pit Vipers, I was one of those 1 out of 50 who went, yes, give me a pair. I will open my wallet. Here is my $60.
So what are some of the main apps, like the must-have apps for a Shopify store and some of your favorite?
I got a love-hate relationship with apps because in the Shopify app store, whatever pain or problem you have, there's an app for that. The problem is it becomes very addictive in that I think a lot of merchants treat that app store like a slot machine. They're just going to keep pulling that lever, hoping they get like, if I just get the right combination of apps, my conversion rate will triple and I'll be a millionaire overnight. And it isn't the case. So Number one, like, if you don't need an app, don't use it. Please use apps sparingly. They're in the food pyramid. Apps are like dessert because they're expensive, both in cost, you know, recurring cost, and in load time on the site, and maintenance and reliability. All right. So with that disclaimer, I think you absolutely need to be focusing on trying to increase average order value, customer lifetime value, and repeat customer rate. And to do that, certainly you want a great email service provider that does email automation. My preference is Klaviyo, but I don't care what tool you use so long as you use it, right? Like, go out, make sure you're running those post-purchase flows. That's number one. Number two, I need an upsell and cross-sell strategy. So I want bundling right on that product page. I like frequently bought together is a really nice widget for that. And, you know, maybe in the cart, I want an upsell. In cart upsell is great for that. A true upsell app I really like is Bold's product upsell. So like one of the best things we ever did for, or one of the things we did for Jay Leno's site was they sold glass cleaner. And then for a few dollars more, they'll sell you glass cleaner and a nice towel that is great for a microfiber towel that's great for glass. And then for a little more, they'll sell you a whole kit for cleaning your interior. So what Bold Upsell does is a true upsell where it will replace the item in your cart with another item if you say yes. So when you add that glass cleaner to cart, the site goes, oh, well, did for just $4 more, did you want the combo? And I think that language is critical. You go, just X more, not like the total dollar value. And when they go yes, it removes the glass cleaner and adds the glass cleaner combo, and then goes, well, for just $30 more, whatever it is, did you want the interior cleaning kit? And if you're like thinking about it and you don't have one yet, you go, yeah, you know what, I would like a clean interior. Well, add that to cart. So now what started as a $10 purchase became a $50 purchase. Whoa. But the conversion rate hasn't changed, the amount of traffic hasn't changed, but my average order value just went up 5x. So you could see where, like, all right, multiply that across several times a day, that happening over a year. Suddenly, this is a non-trivial amount of income.
Yeah, and that makes me so happy because, look, as a guy who runs paid media and distribution and getting traffic to the store, I always say that a company, from an e-commerce perspective, the metric that matters more than return on ad spend is lifetime value and RCR, repeat customer rate. Those are the two that an e-commerce business kind of has to live off of. And I love how you say a company's biggest asset is their list. So what are some ways using your website, not necessarily purchases coming from and growing your list that way, but how can people use their own storefront, their own website to grow their list?
Everyone I've seen who has huge lists, who has engaged lists, creates a lot of content for their newsletter, but also runs giveaways. Like one example is my friend TJ Mapes at Ripped Apparel, RIPT Apparel. They sell gaming-related t-shirts. And I think like every 60 days for years, they have given away a game console. Like that's not, if you think about it, to the end user, free game console, if you're into gaming, that's a pretty good win. That's great. But for you, the business, it's just not that big an expense relative to other advertising. And so you run that as a pop-up strategy on the site, as a social strategy in your social channels. And suddenly, now you're just consistently adding people to your email list. Oh, okay. I mean, everybody who does giveaways, those are the people who I see who have big email lists. And it doesn't have to be, you know, like we work with Hoonigan, the automotive lifestyle brand, and they give away cars. All right, cars pretty good. Like that's a good one to give away. But you don't have to be doing anything huge like that. And you can also just do giveaways on your own products. Like, oh, we'll give you a $100 gift card. That's easy. And for you, if you're doing the manufacturing, the value of a $100 gift card is probably more like $30 to you. But to the end user, it's still $100, right? Yep. It's still a cool giveaway. So I would like having giveaways just as part of your strategies, I think, is critical if you want to consistently grow that email list. That's the only thing we've seen that is just really, really consistently drives it. Depending on your space, you can do like lead magnets and stuff. But
so if that's the case, what's a pop? What, let's discuss pop-up etiquette.
Hell right? Yeah!
Like what? Like give us the rules of etiquette on this one.
I think the trick with on every site, I want to run two pop-ups. I want a welcome pop-up and I want an exit intent pop-up. And I think the magic with the welcome pop-up is you don't do it when the page loads. I find that annoying. I don't think that's the right way to do it. I think you do it on scroll. So that way you keep, it's important to consider quality of traffic with your list. Like if you have spin to win, just enter your email. You're going to, Ben from Privy, the guy who founded Privy, the pop-up building app, he flat out told me, he's like, those work. They have a high opt-in rate. They also generate the lowest quality of email subscriber because you get people who just want to see if they got something for free. So I'm very, having low quality subscribers can also affect your open rate because now your stuff starts going into spam. So I'm very cognizant of that. And so like some email apps are, they're going to charge you by the subscriber, right? So I like to do on scroll, like when they scroll 50% down the homepage, then the welcome pop-up hits. I only want to show it to people who are already engaged and interested. And that scrolling behavior, that's them raising their hand and saying, yeah, okay, I'm interested. You have my attention. And once they've done that, that's when I want to go, great, I'm so glad to have you here. Did you want 10% off your first purchase? It's just like an easy incentive. Oh, now I can get them. And they probably won't buy on that first 10%. But if I have a welcome series, man, that is what's going to drive the revenue. When I was at Klaviyo Boston last year.
Which I think most brands fail on is a welcome series and a solid post-purchase series. I think
no, absolutely.
Yeah.
And because when I at that Klaviyo conference, I did lightning interviews with a whole bunch of merchants and marketers, and I go, "What's your favorite flow?" This is like one of the best questions to ask at an email conference, of course. And to my surprise, I think the number one was our welcome series. They're like, our welcome series drives more revenue than anything else.
And for exit pop up, are you giving them a discount? Are you just asking them a question like, why didn't you buy? Or like, what's the right way to run that?
I think, So the exit intent, I don't think there's like a single, right way to do it. All right. So to plug Privy, they'll do that cart saver where it's like an exit intent that only fires on the cart. That's like, wait, save X percent off your order. And it's like dynamic to the cart, just kind of cool. But I think offer a better promo than that. Like the most success we've ever had with an exit intent was a free gift with purchase offer where we went, oh, wait, don't leave. If you like make any purchase over $50, we'll give you this item and like free with your purchase. And free gift with purchase kills. It's one of the best promos. Like any of our brands that have run those, they've always been very successful. But everybody does it as part of like an email strategy, a traditional strategy. I want it as just this like ongoing pop-up strategy. I think that would be a clever way to do the exit intent.
I want to wrap up with this. I read on your site and something that just really caught my eye and wanted to discuss with you that you didn't experience any real success until you discovered the productized consulting business model.
Yes.
Can you discuss exactly what you mean by that?
Sure. So for as much as possible, I want to provide value to the client and I want to be equitably compensated for it, right? Like those are the basic tenets of consulting. But if I'm going to a car dealership, like imagine this, you go to a car dealership and they go, you're like, all right, I need a car. And they're like, okay, let's ask you some questions. All right, well, we don't know quite what it's going to cost. We'll give you a ballpark estimate. But by the time it's built, it may cost more than that. It's like, that'd be completely goddamn insane. No one makes a purchase like that.
Yeah.
Versus, but that's how we operate consulting agreements, all right? And the advantage to productized consulting is I go, all right, I have built hundreds of Shopify stores. So I have the experience to establish a sane scope of work and attach a fixed price to it and go, this is what you'll get for X amount. And the advantage to that is a lot of people look at that and go, those guys are crazy and leave. And so now I'm not wasting my time on the phone or writing proposals for people that are not a good fit. And that's perfectly fine. But then everyone I do talk to, they know exactly what my services cost. They know exactly what the intervention is. So it makes them comfortable and they know everybody's paying the same rate. And it makes me comfortable because I know like, okay, fundamentally, they know what this is going to cost. The question is, are we a good fit? Not can I afford this? And so I think it's a really sane way to approach consulting. I like it a lot. The disadvantage is like, you can't do value-based fees where it's like, well, you could put in milestones. Like if we get to this revenue, we'll get blah, blah, blah. That's too much. Too much heartache, too much effort for that. I just want, like, look, you're buying an outcome from me, and this is what that outcome costs. And that did, you know, when I said earlier, oh yeah, we did, you know, I tested all the e-commerce platforms. I had a landing page. It was actually for a productized consulting service I called Website Rescues, where I'd be like, I'll go through your site. I'll give you a plan on here's 30 things we'll fix. And then you pay a flat fixed rate for us to fix those things. And there is no, there's no risk in it. Like if we can't, if you don't like my list of 30 suggestions, you don't pay anything. And so that was how we did it. That worked very well to kick off our career. And that model was so sane and so much less stressful than like the proposal and the negotiating and the back and forth that I just stuck with it. I've been doing it ever since.
Love it. Kurt, for the listeners listening right now, if you could tell who are thinking about starting an e-commerce store, think about building a Shopify store, think about getting involved, what would be your advice to them?
Find the overlap between like the pain or problem in your own life, your hobbies and interests, ideally your unfair advantage and what you could sell. That's where you will find success. I've interviewed 100-something merchants at this point, and it is almost a universal story. Someone's like, I had a pain or problem in my life. I couldn't find an adequate solution to it. I said, why not me? Why can't I do this? And then like, I happen to know a guy who knew something or other, and suddenly we're manufacturing this tremendous product that's like better than anything else in the market. That is the same story I've heard from 100 merchants over and over. So if you are looking in your own life and are having a similar experience, go with it. That you will succeed. As long as you can get that in front of people who also went, man, this does suck. We could do something better or different. The money will follow.
Great advice, Kurt, for the listeners who want to reach out to you. How can they find you?
Oh my gosh, Google me. Head to KurtElster.com, sign up for my newsletter. That comes from my real email address. So if you reply to it with a thoughtful question, I will send you a thoughtful response. Probably more, yeah, often, maybe, probably. I don't know, I got two this morning, thoughtful questions. And one I did write a thoughtful response to, and the other one I got bored with. So,
but he won't write fuck you if you unsubscribe.
No, I will not.
I love it. Kurt, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you.
Thank you for having me, Jason. This was great.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for paying attention and tuning into that episode. If you enjoyed it, please do me a favor. Go leave a 5-star review. Leave a review. Leave some comments. Share it with some friends. Spread the love. It would mean the world to me. Thank you so much for your attention and for tuning in. And I will see you on the next episode.